The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Whether you're looking to buy your dream home or rent a sweet apartment, give Redfin your gotta-have-it wish list of property features, and you'll receive real-time notifications tailored just for you. Ready to see it up close and personal? Scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Don't wait to find your perfect match. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special episode on One Heat Minute Productions. I'm your host, Blake Howard. One of the finest Michael Mann acolytes, one of the best film critics in the world, and a person who I've personally looked up to for, decades at this point. Their writing just always inspired me, especially the on time and ahead of time The Gravity of the Flux piece by this author who I'm talking to today really influenced everything that has happened on One Heat Minute and One Heat Minute Productions. I'm so, so pleased that now, in English, Michael Mann, A Contemporary Retrospective is out and available, digital or physical. If you're like me, you're probably going to have both. It is the great Jean-Baptiste Thoret. Jean-Baptiste, thank you so much for coming back and talking to me about this great book. Finally, I've held the French version. I've never been able to understand a word of it other than your pictures and bits and pieces of the French language that I understand, the very limited French that I can read and speak. But it is so great that your great book is finally getting an English translation release. Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Blake. And yes, it's the second time. The first one was a real pleasure, despite my English again. But I'm very happy to be with you again. And I'm very happy also to have this English translation, because a lot of English, American friends told me exactly what you just told, that for them it was impossible to understand what I said about Michael. But you know, it's quite difficult, to be perfectly honest, to find today an editor to translate a book about movies.
Yes.
Because the amount of readers, not only in French, but I think also in the US, in England, in Australia, in Italia, is getting thinner.
Yes.
You know? And it's a kind of risk. It's a bet for an editor today, a publisher, to publish a translation of a book originally published in France. So I'm very happy that, and I am very happy also by the result, because they improved the quality of the picture. You know,
yes.
In the French, some of the picture were a little bit too dark. You have a lot of night shots in Michael Mann movies, so. So it was a little regret I had on my original French version book, and this one they made a great job, you know, and I think that the picture are brighter, and for a reader it's more convenient and comfortable to read, you know.
Yes. Well, there's so many great things in this book, and particularly I want to mention one, which is, with Michael Mann, we talk about style. You and I, just off air, we're talking about the importance of style. Style being almost superior or more of a priority in many ways than the content. And I think that, you know, one of our favorite films, Miami Vice, one of the things I say to people, I'm like, you could get 20 filmmakers to pick that script up and make that movie, and it would be awful. Like, it would be bad. And they could pick up the exact same script and they could make it verbatim. And it's Michael Mann's style that elevates it to the level that it's at. And so I think consuming your book, one of the things I wanted to talk to you the most about, because I think you are the person who has damn near convinced Michael Mann himself these days of this, which is that he gets influenced by other filmmakers. He gets influenced by style. And there's a great part in your Heat section of the book, or you've got many sections of the book. You've got different sort of subheadings. You've got Sharpening, Televisions, The History Factory, The Professionals. And in the Heat section, you've got a little subchapter that is called The Ghost of McQueen. And it was only literally as I was had completed One Heat Minute that I saw Bullet for the first time. And I was watching it and I was enjoying it very much. And I was sitting down and I was relishing just the style and Peter Yates' style and how effortlessly cool Steve McQueen was. And then the conclusion of that movie is an airport foot chase. And my jaw hit the floor, Jean-Baptiste, because I was like, it was like someone had refracted a series of images that I'd been seeing countless times throughout my life and putting them back together in this movie that existed. And I was like, my personal thought was, Michael Mann must love and has seen this movie countless times. And in every interview you read with him, it's not about other films, even though he sees lots of films. But I think that in this book, your little sort of treatise on The Ghost of McQueen and this sequence is probably the most emphatic and the most convincing that Michael Mann is influenced by the style of other filmmakers in some ways. And I just wanted to mention that first up and say it was one of the highlights of the book for me, and in particular as a Heat fan and anyone who's going to be listening to this, if there's one thing you need to read in this contemporary retrospective, it's that section, because I think Jean-Baptiste is the laser focus on it, of what we've all been talking about.
No, in fact, Blake, there are a lot of things in what you just said about Bullet. You know, maybe some people won't be convinced about this kind of relation between Bullet in 1968 and It 1995. But when you see, you just do that, when you see the final sequences of Bullet on the tarmac of the LA airport in LAX, and the final sequences of It, unless you're blind, it's impossible to not see the relation. The question of influence in the Michael Mann movie is quite complex, because Michael Mann don't like so much to admit that is influenced by some directors. I remember 10 years ago, people said, you have seen all the movies by Jean-Pierre Melville.
Yes.
And the Samurai, The Red Circle, and so on. And of course, you have the kind of blood of Jean-Pierre Melville, you know, flooding in your own veins. And Michael Mann was always reluctant, you know, to admit that. But
yes,
the subject is not the influence, but the fact that Michael Mann, as everybody, have seen movies, and
yes,
maybe not conscious of that, and it's absolutely possible that Bullet, some Kubrick's movie, some very modern movie like Antonioni. I think there is a very strong relation between the Antonioni movies of the 60s.
Red Desert particularly is one.
So I think that Bullet is one of the metrics. There are more, but one of the metrics of Michael Mann movies, because Michael Mann didn't appear without nothing before him.
Yes.
You know, just even if he is quite reluctant to say that, but he's part of an American history of movies, you know.
Yes.
starting at the beginning of the late 70s and beginning of the 80s, we could say that he's putting his own stone, a new stone in the American movie story. And about the gangsters, the cops, and so on, it's one of the main genres of the American Hollywood movies. So it's perfectly natural and normal. And I'd say that's very, very important to him to say, so before me, what kind of movie Hollywood was producing, you know?
Yes.
What kind of cops, what kind of gangsters, what kind of relation between what you want to say, what you want to do and what you would like to do. This kind of question, which haunting the American gangster and thriller movies of the 60s and the Michael Mann movies. I mean, for him, it will be wrong to say that before the gangster or the cops in Michael Mann movie, we have never seen this kind of gangster. It's not true. He's putting them in another level, you know?
Yes.
But he's just taking a line which existed before him. Don Siegel, for example, John Borman, Violent Saturday by Richard Fleischer, for example.
Yes.
We could say numerous of examples who explain where Michael Mann is coming from. It's not a way to depreciate the Michael Mann works, absolutely not. But every artist is coming from somewhere, you know, and he's going somewhere. And I mean, the genesis of that, it's not the pleasure to say, oh, have you seen this quotation? It's not very interesting in movies, the quotation. Also, you have seen this movie, you say in your movie that you have seen this one, but so what?
Yes.
What is very interesting is Michael Mann is that he's transforming, you know, the former material, you know, and that's I think it's very interesting. And other thing I would like to say, you were talking about style, and about the you took the example of the script of Miami Vice, just an example.
Yes.
You give the script of Miami Vice to another director, and you see the difference between what Michael Mann did with that. Well, I mean, I think that if we had to be a little bit radical, you know, the story in a movie, it's not so interesting.
Nah.
You have maybe 10, 15 kind of stories in all the history of cinema. You know, well,
yeah.
So what make an artist? It's not the story. It's even not the dialogues. You know, it's images and sounds and the way you're using pure cinema to do something with this art. You know, and when you said style and content, I think that style is content.
Yes. Yes.
I always make a big difference between content and story.
Yes.
Sometimes the style is going against the story.
Yes.
Who is right? I think the style is always right.
Yes.
You know, against the story. Some average director or some bad director, they don't use style to say other things than the story. So, okay, I can read the book. If the content of your movie is a story, what's the use for cinema?
Yes.
I don't need that. In Michael Mann, the content, the feeling, the way you're understanding, you know, the relation between the people, the relation between people and the world, everything is in the style.
Yes.
It's not in the story. That's the reason I won't separate, you know, style and content. For me, first is style, and from the style, you're deducting. Yeah, you have an idea of what the movie is about. I'm not sure I'm very clear about that, but I tried.
No. I think you're so right. It's that's the gap that I see in this very in where people have taken contemporary technology to tell stories, and yet for me, when I watch, and I'll use a big franchise like Star Wars. And I recently, I sent a message to a friend. I was watching some of the, one of the new Star Wars as I was just killing some time. And I said, remember when Star Wars was grand? Remember when the scope was, when it dwarfed you, when there were possibilities? Okay, now it's just a Star Trek episode from like the 1960s. Okay, it's just people in a room talking. The camera's not moving. I don't feel moved. And although there might be movement, like actor performance style or gestural style and things like that, if it's not complemented with the way that you capture and enhance those images, then it's just nothing. It's deadening. It's there's no feelings happening. And that's, I think, where no matter how many times I go back to a Michael Mann film, that's the harmony of his ability to capture those images and that story, even in the most sort of boring of scenes, and the way that he does his montages and the sort of bombardment of information sometimes, and you're just sort of there. He's like, you'll catch up. You know, his philosophy is the audience is very intelligent and intuitive. You will catch up. I go, I love not having to be dumbed down. And I feel like a lot of these smaller scale, very television focused things, they've got such a small focal point. They just want to tell you a very easy serial kind of like a daytime television thing. And that does not satiate me personally in the slightest. So that, I think you've nailed that. And the one point is, I love what you said about Michael Mann as a person who comes from something, because that very traditional auteur theory is, you know, auteurs come down from a magical place, then they're devoid of political context. And what I love about Michael Mann is I love his context. This is a guy who was interested in documentary cinema, you know, learned in Europe, went and studied film, you know, exciting documentary techniques, new technology, and comes back. And he really only gets a chance to make films in the sort of latter part of the 1970s and early 80s. And he's displaced. He's like making films that were made 15 years ago in the 80s. So when you look at Thief, it fits. It could have played 2 weeks after Bullet. And
Because you're right. In fact, there are two things. First one is the question you're mentioning that was one of my guide in in the process of the writing of the book. It was the process of anachronism. I remember one day I was about to film Michael Mann for a documentary I made a few years ago called We Blew It, and I called him and I said to him that. I wanted to make a film interview with him for my movie. And it was about what happened to the counterculture. How do we pass from Easy Rider to Donald Trump? That was my he said to me, yes, but I made my first movie in 1980, so I'm not really part of what you call the American movies of the 70s or the new Hollywood movement, you know? And I said to him, yes, you directed your first movie in 1980, Thief, but I think you're anachronistic. I don't know if that's the word. Anachronistic director. I mean, it's important to make a distinction between the date of the production of a movie and the date of the movie in aesthetic terms. I mean,
yes.
The 1980 movie, of course, you're right, it's official, but it's a movie of maybe 69 or 70.
Easily.
For example, you have a lot of movies today in 2024, tomorrow 2025. You could say that they have been directed in 1951.
Yeah.
Yes. In 1977. If you just forgetting the clothes, the cars, you know, it's you have a lot of old movies going out today. A lot of old movies.
Yes.
And so I said to Michael Mann at that moment, you're right, you're officially you're not part of the new Hollywood movement, but for me you are a director of the 70s dropped in the 80s.
Yes.
So you are late. And that's one of the key things of all the Michael Mann movies. All the his main characters have the feeling to be late. They don't have time, you know. Time is locked.
Yes.
Time is locked, said Gong Li in Miami Vice. And he said to me, ah, okay, I'm okay to answer to your question. And, that's very interesting, because this paradox of being an American director, maybe one of the last of the 70s, making movies during the 80s and the 90s and the 2020s and so on, it's part of the specificity of the Michael Mann movie.
Yes.
When you see Thief, when you see Heat, Miami Vice, and so on, as Michael Mann tried to say, okay, what can we keep alive from the 70s, you know, even in the 80s and even today and so on. And for me, he's a real director of the 70s, and this anachronistic, you know, characteristic of him is the heart of his movie. And another thing about style, when you see the opening sequences, for example, of Miami Vice, of Heat, of Manhunter, I remember when I was teaching movies at the French university, I always made this kind of experience. I was, showing to my students a clip of a movie. And after that, I said to them, okay, now we are going to put the sound down. What happened to what you just said without the sound? You know, without the dialogue and so on. Most of the movie, not all of them, of course, but most of the movie don't resist to this operation.
Yes.
You know, if you are putting away the sound, you don't understand nothing. What the character are saying, what the plot, what the story. In the case of Michael Mann movie, if you putting the sound out away of the beginning of it, of Manhunter, for example, you still understand perfectly what's going on. I mean, the guy on the beach, the kind of melancholic mood of Will Graham, this big piece of tree, you know, sign of something is going wrong. You have this epinal, this perfect image of the happiness, but in the middle of the frame, you have this black and huge piece of tree. That means that something is not so perfect as it seems to be, you know. And this guy is coming from the background and putting some pictures of some gruesome pictures. You understand everything, the kind of conversation. You don't need to have words to have dialogues in this sequence. The same thing appear in Miami Vice, you know, this mix between a pure attraction and seduction of this world, you know, beautiful limousine, beautiful woman, and so on. But at the same time, something very, very, very bad, you know, very negative, you know, and you don't. I mean, that's the reason if you give the script of Heat, Manhunter, or Miami Vice to someone else, everything will change, of course, since you see that for Michael Mann's style is the way to tell a story, of course, but it's a way to say, here is my content, you know?
Yes.
Miami Vice without the style of Michael Mann is not Miami Vice. It's not a story of undercover cops. We have seen that thousands of times, you know. It's not very original, to be honest. That's not the value of Miami Vice. It's not the story. So no, it's the way Michael Mann is filming this story, and the way he's showing to us the real content on the movie. It's not about two undercover cops. That's the first level, you know, of the story. It's not so interesting.
It's superficial at this point. Yes, completely superficial.
Yes. That's for YouTubers. That's for TikTok. Anyway, but when you're trying to have a deeper understanding of what's going on, it's about capitalism. It's about melancholia. It's about existentialism. I always say that if I would like to show to my children or to friends in 10 or 15, in 20 years, what the world the 80s and 90s and 2000, how it was, I show to them Michael Mann movies.
Yes.
The mood of our time era is encapsulated, you know, in Michael Mann movies.
Yes.
I won't show them documentaries, in fact. I show them, look at it, look at Miami Vice, and you will understand how was the world in the 2000. And, you know, it's very far from this cop and gangster story, you know. It's just the Horse of Troy.
Yes, yes.
But what is in the Horse of Troy? Something more profound, more powerful, I think.
Absolutely. I also think you touched on that beautiful scene in Manhunter. And in English, we say, well, I'm not sure how common the phrase is, but when you see wood or trees come up on the beach, we call it driftwood. So it's a drift, you know? So you see Will Graham and you see Jack Crawford, so Dennis Farina and William Peterson, and you see them there. And the fact that they're having this meeting and he's showing them photos of these happy families before he gets to these disgusting images that he consumes to recover this mindset. He's already adrift. And the metaphor is so strong in just every part of the composition. It's like, I don't need to see a word. I don't need, just that image is enough. It's enough. Mm-hmm. There's a great little film that was recent, actually. It was only a couple of years ago, 2022. Was directed and written by a guy named John Patton Ford. It's called Emily the Criminal. It starred Aubrey Plaza. And that film, for me, it's so funny, feels like a successor to Thief because it's about the desperation of capitalism and what capitalism does to the littlest person. You know, how these capitalistic structures exploit you to the point that you're pushed to the edge that crime becomes this logical step. And it's so funny. It's like that movie. I'm like, I'm watching that. I'm like, that's a movie that could have been displaced in its own way. That's a movie that could be in the 80s after Thief. Like it's the same themes are coming back. So it's so interesting. I want to come back to one of the things you talk about in your great book, Michael Mann, A Contemporary Retrospective. Talking about specifically in Manhunter, you said decor appears to be over-dramatized. I'm paraphrasing you. And you said it kind of ends up visually matching its characters. And so I think it starts on the beach with that driftwood, he's adrift. But I want to talk to you about in Manhunter because I think that that's something that people subliminally have responded to and reacted to, especially those of us who've loved it for many, many years. We keep going back because every space in Manhunter is reflective of the inner life of every character that you're seeing in those scenes. You know, the isolating hotel rooms with lights of hotel, you know, lights in the background of buildings with, you know, elevators flickering behind them, or, you know, the homes of the victims, or Francis Dolarhyde's incredible home. And so I'd love to talk to you about just that over-dramatization and particularly in the way that every single set seems to be so of its time, but almost out of time because it's so tied to character. And I think that Manhunter is almost like the exemplar of that. It gets it so right in every single sense throughout the whole film.
You know, I think that Manhunter in Michael Mann career it's a kind of turning point.
Yes,
I mean because it's he made two movies before that, Thief, which is a very realistic movie in the like a 70s movie, you know. And when you see the Chicago of a Thief, it's not the touristic version of Chicago. It's very ordinary spaces and diners and streets and bridges and so on. It's a movie made in the tradition of the 70s, you know, cops and killers thriller movie. 2 years later, he made The Keep.
And yes,
another big dossier, a big file in Michael Mann movie. But he made The Keep for different reasons. The Keep is not exactly what Michael Mann wanted the movie to be. But it's interesting because it's a kind of a real flip side from Thief. Thief is a real movie with real people in a very realistic urban environment and setting. And in Keep, it's a kind of expressionistic, yes. You know, the vision. It's like Fritz Lang and some of the Fritz Lang movie are quoted, you know,
yes.
in The Keep. Just after these two movies, you have Manhunter. Manhunter is a kind of balance, a mix, a kind of synthesis, you know, of these two earlier movies. You know,
yes.
You make Thief plus The Keep, you have Manhunter.
Yes.
And what is very interesting in Manhunter, it's maybe is more a kind of... maybe the most expressionistic, except of course The Keep, of Michael Mann movie. So for the first time, he's using the settings, the suburbs, the vaults, you know, the absolutely supernatural and irrational, you know, way of filming the cities and the landscape in a very mental way. I mean, if you think that the Atlanta, for example, is looking exactly like, as you see in Manhunter, you're wrong, you know.
Yes.
I mean, is Atlanta in the mind of this profiler, you know, looking this way, you know.
Yes.
And the way the cities and the buildings, you know, very specific kind of buildings, you know, are reflecting the psyche and the complex psyche of Will Graham seems to me very important, because after that, Michael Mann will always use this kind of relation between the cities, the landscape, the you know, the settings, and the main character.
Yes.
If you want to see to know what the main character is thinking about, just see where he is, what he's looking at. You know, the one of the most famous example is the example of Neil McCauley going home, you know, putting his the gun on the table and going to the window and looking at the Pacific Ocean, you know.
Yes.
Kind of a trademark. And I am fed up to each time you're typing Michael Mann on the internet. it's a parenthesis, but I just knew one thing when I wrote this book, that I didn't want to have this picture on the cover of it, you know? Anyway, it's a very important, of course, shot. Maybe one of the most key shot of Michael Mann movies. But what we see in this movie is that if you want to understand what is in the mind of Robert De Niro, you know, and it's very interesting because Robert De Niro is blur in the frame.
Yeah. Yes.
So that means that what is mine is what is sharp, and what is sharp is the landscape, is the beach. The ocean. So that's the clue to understand what is in his mind at this particular moment. And Manhunter is always that. You mentioned the house of Dollar Hyde, but nobody is living in this kind of house, you know, except a sick mind. I don't know. But what was very interesting for me, that the way that this house is full of objects of the past.
Yes.
You know, of the 50s or 60s, and specifically it's full of objects of the Catholic world. You
yes.
know, antennas, the old television, you know, and it's
and a space, and a space mural. I think one thing I really love is that it's a space mural. So it's like it's a relic in and of itself, because by the mid to late 1980s, the space race, and you would probably associate that mural with something in like a Los Angeles kind of desert home from like a film noir. But it's like it's someone who has got just everything about the house is relics.
You're right, because this space wall is, I think, is telling to us two different things. The first one is for this guy, Dollar Hyde, this space, maybe it's the surface of Mars or the moon. I don't know exactly. But that means that for this guy is a kind of frontier, a kind of utopia. That means that this guy is living in a world before 1969.
Yes.
Because after 69, we don't dream about the moon. It's done. Maybe Kubrick has landing. But anyway, but that means that the imaginary of this guy is belonging to an ancient time. I mean, to the 50s or 60s.
Mm.
And that's really important. The other comment we could make about this space wall, that this guy is living in a foreign on a planet.
Yes,
you know, he's not living among us.
He's an alien. This is his landscape, but where we are, it's unrecognizable to him.
Absolutely. And when you see this house and all these objects, and we know how Michael Mann is very attached to choose very precisely what kind of object you see in the frame. He's a very perfect guy. It's impossible to say, some prop man forgot this television in the foreground. Of course, it's not the case in Michael Mann movie. Nah. So, you know, a lot of things just by looking at the house of Dollar Hyde before seeing Dollar Hyde. And the other subject for me was the question of television, because I always thought that the relation between Michael Mann and television, it's a hate and love relation.
Mm.
You know, you know that by heart, of course, but Michael Mann, when he was young, was supposed in his mind to make movies much earlier.
Yes.
You know? Wanted to make movies, but the fate and the events decided in another way, you know. And finally, he had to work for television quite for a long time. And of course, he learned a lot of things to write, to build stories, and also to film images, which for some of them will reappear, you know, in his movies later. A kind of training, you know, when you see LA Takedown in 1989, for example, it's a fascinating piece of work and quasi unique in the history of cinema. A guy is making his first draft, looking for the big moment for movies. It's the difference between LA Takedown and Heat, you know.
There is no better evidence
of the
difference between television and cinema than watching LA Takedown and Heat, because one of them is made for cinema and the other one is made for television. And it's almost like I would encourage any young filmmaker, if they ever want to go and make television, it's like, yeah, sure. Before you go and make television, Michael Mann made LA Takedown with a television budget, and then he made Heat with a cinema budget, and just look at, like, the scripts are almost beat for beat.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a lot of the same content. And it feels so much smaller. It's a it's a fascinating document. It's a fascinating exercise to watch both of those two things.
Yes, and there is no relation between the two except the story, and that prove that the story that's not so much important when you see the gap between the two versions. No? So, but the story is almost the same.
Yes.
You know, even the very famous conversation between De Niro and Pacino, it's the same kind of framing.
Yes.
You know, I don't know. But in one way, it's just a TV movie. You know, in the other way, it's a piece of art.
Yes.
I think that, especially it's very important today, because for a lot of moviegoers or young people, they say that the difference between movies and TV is not so important. And we have to fight against this terrible idea. Alors, a lot of different things can explain that. First, a lot of movies going to theaters today looking at telefilms.
Yes.
TV. So that's a reason. It's not because you're putting your own movies, your own movie on a theater that it became cinema. No, it's not enough, you know. Yeah. But the difference between TV and cinema is very important. And I think it's one of the subjects of hidden subject of some of the Michael Mann movies. Remember when Al Pacino, when he's pissed off, he's putting away the TV of his wife, you know, in a street in Los Angeles. It's very difficult for me to not see Michael Mann at his moment of his career, you know, putting away the TV from him.
Can I just say, this doesn't happen often, but you've just made me realize the essay of that scene in this conversation. The only person that is in both LA Takedown and Heat is Xander Berkeley, who plays Ralph.
All right.
And Michael Mann, right then, he plays Wayne Grow in LA Takedown, and he then plays Ralph in Heat. And it is him in that moment. It is Michael Mann almost having an essay in the film that is saying, abandoning the television. He's like, the draft is gone. It could not be more overt.
Absolutely. It's a coming out, you know, right in the middle of the frame, you know. And
it's right there. It's been in front of me the whole time, Jean-Baptiste. And I'm like, just talking to you now, I'm like, no wonder this show, no wonder Heat was a very worthy examination for a number of years and still continues. I still find things in it, is because right there could not be a better argument for the difference between television and movies and wanting to escape the prison of being known as a television producer rather than a filmmaker.
Of course, and we could almost say also that Dollar Hyde in Manhunter is a pure product of the nightmare of the TV of the 80s.
Yes,
I think that Manhunter is filming another opposition, confrontation. You have, of course, Dollar Hyde against Will Graham and so on. But the you have a kind of hidden fight in Manhunter between television and cinema. And that's very interesting because Dollar Hyde is a pure cathodic creature.
Yes.
You know? And you remember this scene when he's going near the house of Reba, and
yes.
Thinks that he has a kind of a new relation, and he's living the way of the false cathodic images and soap opera and so on,
yes.
And finally entering the world, the real world. And when he's entering this real world, he has at this moment a chance to cure himself.
Yes.
Know? It's because you are prisoner, you're staying in the cathodic world, you're still a criminal.
Yes.
And at that moment, you look at Reba, but in misunderstanding, you know, the scene. You remember, you know, nothing happened between Reba and her colleague. But he sees this scene differently. For him, it's a kind of a very bad soap opera scene, you know. And
yes.
He has the impression that Reba is kissing, she's offering herself to this guy, but nothing like that happened. That's very interesting because Michael Mann showed us at that moment the television images, soap opera, TV series, and so, like a poison.
Yes.
The poison, vampirizing your imaginary, you know, and he's unable to see the reality unless going through the filter of the TV. And I think that...
He sees in videotape, Jean-Baptiste. And that from the first moment he's walking up the stairs, when you see his POV, he's seeing in videotape.
He's a video guy. And I mean, saying that in 1986, it's very different. It's the explosion of TV, of MTV, of the VHS, of the video club and so on. At that moment, the assault of the TV you know, ecosystem,
yes,
against the movie is very, very strong, you know. And I think that one, what maybe the profound, you know, meaning of Dollar Hyde is not just a sick guy, of course, but the again, the hidden subject, you know, of Manhunter for me is that, if you want.
Yeah. And he gets Tom Noonan to play. He gets Tom Noonan to play Kelso later on, who's a guy who's all about TVs and all about screens, and he's just another refraction of that kind of that philosophy. Is just this guy who's immersed, and he's been able to live more comfortably and be stuck, but he's not quite Dollar Hyde, but it's definitely something that he's interested in.
But you know, Blake, you were saying a little earlier the importance for Michael Mann of the technology.
Yes.
And you have a lot of directors are fascinating by technology and try to use a new Viper, the new Sony. Or the, yeah. Okay. So what's the purpose? You're filming a very ordinary scene with a new Viper 3.0, but there is no difference between an old, you know, movies and this version of the movie. What's very interesting for me with Michael Mann that he is a kind of experimentator. He's a very interesting of the new technology, but not for the technology itself. It's not very interesting, but what this technology is saying about our world.
Yes.
What this technology, how this technology is modifying, is changing our perception of the world. And in every Michael Mann movie, from Manhunter and the TV to Black Hat and The Social Network, and even in Heat, the Kelso character, you know, saying that the information is in the air. It's a very strange, you know, line at that moment, but I think it's each time in the Michael Mann movie, you have a passion for the new technology, but the most important is, okay, we have this new technology, but what this technology is saying about the world? Are the relation between men and women and so on are affected by this technology? And that's very interesting because Michael Mann is always trying to make a kind of documentary through the fiction of
yes.
our world, you know. And when you see Black Hat, it's a very up-to-date movie, you know, about what is the world of social network and computers and so on in 2015. And that's for me very important. And the same thing appeared in Miami Vice, you know, because the technology, you were talking about the question of TV in Manhunter and so on. But look at today, we see the world through the what we call the social medias.
Yes.
You know, and we could analyze our world today, you know, the violence, the fall of the culture, a lot of things because of the social media. You know, it's not,
yes.
The technology is politics. And
yes.
Michael Mann is trying to show in his movie. It's technology has a lot of effects of politics, on humanity, on a lot of different things, you know. And what I think it's what he's trying to show. When you see it, for example, I tried in my book to explain the different stages of capitalism in Michael Mann movies. Because
yes.
The capitalism in Thief, the way Michael Mann is showing the capitalism, is not the same as the capitalism in It, in Collateral in 2004, and in Black Hat. It's following the evolution of that. When
yes.
you take James Caan in Thief, for example, and you're going 15 years after that, and you're going to Neil McCauley in It, and you're going to Vincent in Collateral in 2004, you can see the evolution of the capitalism. They are same. All of them are part of the same line. You know what I mean?
Yes, they yes. Are, it's the same. It's a continuing thread, and
absolutely.
And also, even in the technology, and this is one thing I love what you said before about the so what of what we're seeing in some of our mass media or like mass consumption sort of stories that are on television usually or streaming services now. They use the technology and they do it. And the so what is like, okay, well, you can do it, but why are you doing it? And I think that Collateral
for me, which is nearly 20 years old, is one thing that fascinates me in Michael Mann's work, because I got to speak to his great supervising sound editor, Elliot Koretz. And what Elliot told me, and he told me it from a very practical sense, but I think it has a great application philosophically to Michael Mann, is like, Blake, when we saw what Michael Mann was showing us with the digital photography and Collateral, it changed the way that we edited layers of sound, because the images, the depth of field, you could see a boundless distance. Like previously, if you're just shooting on 35mm film, if you're shooting on 35, you can't see as far as you can see. And so even in the form, he's going like, technology is enabling us to see more, to have more, whether it's digital noise, there's more things we have to address because there's just so much in the frame. And that's in every single moment of Collateral. And that kind of lesson, that through line goes all the way to like Black Hat, where some people at the time in 2015 were like, oh, this is a bit extreme. It's going pretty far with this. And Michael Mann, you know, retrospectively has said, maybe I didn't go far enough, because like everything that I thought was nightmarish in Black Hat has happened. You know, it's definitely happened. I could have gone way further. And we thought we were being just, you know, documentarians in that way. So I think that's the one thing about Michael Mann's use of technology I think other filmmakers don't do. It's that form has a function. Like in opening up the landscape, it's in the characters. Like Max's mind is being expanded with the catalyst of Vincent, and the film itself, although grainy, we're getting a bigger view of LA at night than we've ever seen before. We're seeing into the darkness in a way that we've never seen before. And what are the effects of us seeing more and having more audiovisual noise in our lives and manifested in these damn screens we carry around in our pockets, like all the time, there's just noise. And sometimes it's just like, I need to disconnect. You know,
And you're right, because it fits also with the way Vincent is looking at the reality and the universe. He said himself, when he's coming, he hates Los Angeles, the indifference, the multitude, he's lost in the crowd, he's just a little star in the big universe and so on. And what you're saying about the sound participate to the same kind of idea, you know?
Yes.
Finally, the world is not turning just around me.
Yes.
You know? You have a lot of sounds. You have coyotes, you have clouds, you have storms. You have
planes flying over the heads of Tom Cruise, you know?
It's a way to put the human figure in a real place, you know?
Yes,
It's not the center of the universe no more, you know? And for Vincent, this idea is quite frightening, because this guy is trying to control everything. And suddenly, it's not possible to control finally the sound, the storm, you know, the sound of a diner, of a car, of a plane. And he feels, in fact, threatened by this, you know, university. But I was thinking when I was listening to you about Robert Altman. You know Robert Altman?
Yes, yes.
This guy tried in the early 70s in MASH, in John McCabe, in Nashville, and so on, to correct this way of the 35mm don't allow you know, to show the size of the universe, you know. Two guys in the foreground are talking, but a lot of people, it's a movie convention. When you see in a restaurant, you're just hearing the two guys talking at the foreground, and the other are just making lip sync, you know. And Altman made the contrary at that moment, and everybody is talking at the same time. So you as a moviegoer, as a spectator, you have to make the work. You have to pick up and to choose what's important in the frame, but the director won't do that for you.
Yes.
You have to make the work, the job, if you want. And I think it's the same kind of, you know, idea. I mean, how technology can reframe you know, the way you're looking at the world. It was a specific idea for Robert Altman, because with the 35 millimeter, it because of lights and so on, it was impossible to increase the depth, you know, and the depth field. But it was possible to increase the sound field, you know, and in Collateral is possible for him to improve both, you know,
yes,
the sound and the image at the same time, in fact.
Yes. Well, this has been a magnificent follow-up conversation. Thank you so much for coming back and talking to me again. Everyone who listens to this show religiously really or to do themselves a favor and purchase your book. And it's so great talking to you again. And thank you so much. It's a pleasure to know you. And these conversations, I feel like you and I could just go on forever, but I'll save it up for other conversations. And also what's very exciting in the new book and in the English translation is your words on Ferrari. So you got to have a talk about Ferrari, which is very, very exciting. That, you know, it's always the way when someone's writing him, someone who is a great follower of Michael Mann like you, just writes the book, publishes it, and then Ferrari comes out. So at least now you got a chance to kind of tackle Ferrari and get it into this version of the book, which is very exciting.
It's nice, Blake, but it was difficult for Ferrari because I was in Los Angeles at late June, and Michael Mann showed me the movie, but the movie was not completely finished.
Yes.
It was 98% finished, but for Michael Mann, 2% is very important.
That's a lot. That's a lot for him.
And I remember when he showed me the movie, he was taking notes and pages of notes again. These colors, the blue is not enough profound because we don't hear this car enough anyway. But just a word about Ferrari, because it's very interesting what you said about style. Mm. When you see Ferrari, a lot of people, as always, people are talking too fast. You know,
yes.
But they said, "Oh, it's a kind of return to a very classical form." You know, and for a lot of people today, it's very difficult to make the difference between classical and academical.
Yes,
John Ford is classical. Clint Eastwood is classical. Ferrari is classical. I mean, they will last forever.
Yes,
that's the big difference between academical, you know,
yes,
or à la mode, as we say. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
When you're à la mode, that means that 2 weeks later you're very outdated.
Yes,
it's and the Ferrari is very interesting because Michael Mann is precisely is choosing to not to go back but to use a very classical style for a simple reason that you are in 1957 in Modena, a kind of village. That's the first time Michael Mann, except the keep, is putting his camera in a village. I mean. Ferrari and Collateral, for example, or Ferrari and Black Hat are the two opposite, you know, face of the same coin, you know?
Yes.
And what is fascinating that Adam Enzo Ferrari in the movie, is acting like a Michael Mann hero, but is totally disconnected with this environment. He thinks that he could act like Vincent in Collateral, in Neil McCauley in Heat, you know, this flux, you know, the huge flux, this indifference. But in Modena, it's impossible to apply, you know, the rules of this mondialistic world of the 19 and 2000, and all the conflict of the Ferrari as this kind of relation between what Adam Driver like a Martian going from Los Angeles, you know, put in Modena 1957, I think that all the rules of the LA of the 19 will still work, you know, 40 years back in a small village in Italy, but not. And that's one of the core, I think, of the movie. And it's a fascinating movie, too, of course. I don't know what you think about Ferrari.
Oh, no, I immediately thought what you said, which is that it's told classically because of the time. Like, Michael Mann is a filmmaker who makes either things that, say, Last of the Mohicans, which feel so of a piece and so in time and in space and in a
like a social political reality, which you don't usually say for colonial wars, but it's in the social political reality of that time, and it's shot beautifully and it's shot in that way. And then you have a look at something like Public Enemies, which again, we were talking a lot about technology. It's like the filmmaking technology there is paired with the radical transformation of police technology. And so that those things pair so beautifully. For me, when I saw him make this movie more classically, as some people have said, or sort of tried to dismiss it, I think they were saying pejoratively that that was what it was. I was like, no, it's told with like operatic confidence. This is a filmmaker who knows exactly what he's doing, and he's literally showing us Adam Driver. This disconnection is because Ferrari was an outlier. He was thinking way ahead. He is meant to be the disconnected person. Everyone else is firmly in that reality, and he's outside of it, and he's trying to do things differently, but he can't break away from his time. And I thought it was masterful. I just immediately loved it, and I can't go and see him. It's impossible for me to go and see my favorite filmmaker's new film and especially one I knew he was trying to make for 20 years and not be impressed, firstly. And it's also gorgeous to look at. And I think in your book, in the afterword, you talked about just these little beautiful Michael Mann kind of anti-classical flourishes in it, like the knobs and buttons of the cars and the way that it's shot and the frenetic pace of those exchanges and the sound. But no, I thought it was magnificent. I really enjoyed it. And I think it's going to age beautifully. And I think that's the one thing that's so funny, Jean-Baptiste. I don't know if you see it. I follow it quite a bit. Is Ferrari didn't do well by box office standards, whatever that means. They put that thing on streaming recently, and it was the most popular movie that was on streaming in America for a whole week.
I know that. Okay.
And people are like, oh, this movie's really good. It's like, yeah, it is. It would have been nice if you went to the theaters. And what happens? Black Hat came to Netflix a couple of years ago. It was the most popular movie on Netflix for like 2 months. People are like, what? This doesn't make sense. Miami Vice comes onto Netflix. It's the most popular movie for 2 months. And it's like, yeah, because you are eating gruel every day. And then you put this magnificent Michael Mann thing on a streaming service and people watch it and they're enraptured and they're like, wow, what was that? It looked good. It was interesting. It didn't spoon feed me like all the other content. Yeah, that's because he's a master. He's a master.
Yeah. And he's not preparing it too. I guess you're very impatient to see what
impatient is a word. Very impatient. I'm the keenest and most excited potential consumer of that. And I just hope that they I want them to give him the ability to make the movie in the way that he should make it. Give him the money, let him go and make it, let him shut down roads in Los Angeles and shoot the thing in LA and let him fly to Ciudad del Este and let him do all the magnificent casting time, you know, before or after, older, younger, do whatever he needs to do. It just feels like I trust less the mechanism for him to make it than I implicitly and absolutely trust his ability to make it, because his craft is still,
and he's very sharp too, because Michael Mann is now 81 years old.
Yes. Yeah.
I met him several times during the past 2 years because I was in Los Angeles. He came to Paris very, very kindly to support the release of the book 2 years ago and so on. And he's a very sharp guy. You know, youth is not a question of age, you know.
Yes.
You can see that when you're talking with Michael Mann, and it's quite impressive. And he's carrying this project for a very long time, in fact, you know.
Yes.
It's not something he decided just a few months ago, oh, I'm going to make Heat 2. And I think he worked a lot on the script and so on. And so we'll see. But like you, I'm more than impatient. There is no word in English.
There's no word in French, and there's no word in English for how impatient we both are. But look, I'm so glad that my impatience for the English translation of your book is now done. I can consume it anytime I want. So thank you so much for talking to me. It's always a pleasure. And your English is fantastic.
No, you're
vastly better than my French. So thank you so much. And
next time, maybe I will try to improve a little bit my English just for you.
That is absolutely unnecessary. Now that we're talking, I'm going to Los Angeles in August of this year. I'm going to try and see if I can get along to meet the man himself and then harass him about when Heat 2 is coming. Jean-Baptiste, thank you so much. You're the best. I really appreciate your time. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.